All right. So we're going to be discussing catecholamines this week. The first of the biogenic amines. Everybody familiar with what the term biogenic amine means from your readings? Okay. So dopamine pathways in the nervous system are fairly simple compared to an awful lot of the other biogenic amines. Basically, dopamine comes from two major sources in your brain, in the midbrain. One is called the substantia nigra, the black stuff, or the black substance from Latin translation, which provides primarily the dopaminergic input to the dorsal striatum, also known as the basal ganglia. You may know the particular type of neurons it comes from in the substantia nigra. Those in the pars compacta, the very small dopamine neurons. And then the dopamine that supplies most of the rest of the nervous system, particularly the forebrain, comes from what is called the ventral tegmental area, or VTA, ventral tegmental area. Okay. And we'll talk a little bit today about some structures like the accumbens, frontal cortex. But it's certainly not limited in its targets just to those two areas. It goes to other limbic areas like the... anybody know what this one is? The anterior cingulate. Goes to the hippocampus, which they didn't bother to put in this diagram. Goes to other areas associated with the limbic system, like the piriform cortex. And to regions within the hypothalamus, the median eminence. So except for the basal ganglia, the majority of the dopamine comes from the ventral tegmental area. Now, I know how you all like biochemical pathways. This is a critically important one. Hint, 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 hint. Important, perhaps, to know for the synthesis of catecholamines. Okay, we begin with the precursor amino acid tyrosine. Tyrosine, it's a dietary amino acid. It can cross the blood-brain barrier and is transported into neurons. It's acted upon by an enzyme called tyrosine hydroxylase. Tyrosine hydroxylase, or TH. It is also called the rate-limiting enzyme for synthesis of the catecholamines. Rate-limiting. What might that mean? It limits the rate at which you can synthesize catecholamines. And we'll look at some of the mechanisms by which it's limited in just a moment. The product of this enzyme, using tyrosine as its substrate, is a compound called DOPA. DOPA. You've probably heard of it in one of its isomeric forms, L-DOPA. Is that ever used for anything? It's a drug that's used for treatment of what disorder?
Parkinson's.
Okay. It also crosses the blood-brain barrier. But without tyrosine, you don't produce very much of it. Hence, Parkinson's patients could be given supplements of L-DOPA. Okay. DOPA is converted by another enzyme into dopamine. And the enzyme, unfortunately, has two names. I'm going to teach you the newer name, which is more accurate, but also refer occasionally to the older name. Hello, Kyle. The newer name looks like it's something you might associate with your car. AAADC. AAADC. That stands for aromatic amino acid. Aromatic amino acid, that's the AAA. Decarboxylase. Aromatic amino acid decarboxylase. That's why we use abbreviations. AAADC. It used to have a different name. It used to be erroneously called DOPA decarboxylase. DOPA decarboxylase. But about 40 years ago now, we discovered that it was not specific just to DOPA as a substrate. In fact, we'll see it in another biosynthetic pathway when we talk about serotonin. So calling it DOPA decarboxylase is incorrect. Unfortunately, most people that write textbooks took pharmacology more than 40 years ago, or at least it certainly seems to be the case. So you'll still see it often referred to as DDC. You can then correct people if they use the term DDC and tell them, no, it should be called AAADC, and you know why. That enzyme converts DOPA into dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter. It can be packaged up into vesicles and released in a calcium-dependent fashion. There's another associated drug you need to learn, though. And that drug is carbidopa. Carbidopa. Carbidopa is often used in combination with DOPA to treat Parkinson's patients. Carbidopa blocks AAADC. It prevents the enzyme from converting DOPA into dopamine. Well, wait a minute. In Parkinsonism, the disorder is a lack of dopamine in the striatum. So why would you want to treat a Parkinson's patient with something that could be converted into dopamine and then also treat them with something that blocks the enzyme that allows the DOPA to be converted into dopamine? Pardon? Because DOPA can cross the blood-brain barrier. Carbidopa cannot. Guess what? There's dopamine in your peripheral nervous system. Remember we looked at the autonomic nervous system last class? And dopamine serves as a neurotransmitter regulating cardiovascular function as well from the sympathetic nervous system. If you treat a Parkinson's patient with something that boosts dopamine and you don't prevent the peripheral production of dopamine, you're going to have a patient whose motor dysfunction is relieved, but they're going to die probably of a stroke or a heart attack because of extreme high blood pressure. Probably not, you know, a good FDA approval technique. So if you give them carbidopa, it prevents that increase in blood pressure peripherally. Leaves more of the DOPA to be transported to the nervous system, where it can then have the beneficial effect in the basal ganglia. Once it's been converted by the AAADC in the brain, because the carbidopa, again, doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier and interfere with that conversion. Okay, for dopamine neurons, we stop there. They've only got to have these two enzymes to produce dopamine. If they're a norepinephrine neuron, different location in the brain, they will have an additional enzyme to convert dopamine into the next catecholamine, norepinephrine. That enzyme is called DBH, or dopamine beta hydroxylase. If you get real curious why it's called beta hydroxylase, this is looking at the basic catechol structure, the ring, and then this ethylamine side chain, and they're labeled alpha and beta carbons on that side chain. So it acts at that particular point. Dopamine beta hydroxylase. And in fact, if you look at the side chain, you can see that extra hydroxyl group added on. It distinguishes norepinephrine from dopamine. Dopamine beta hydroxylase converts dopamine into norepinephrine. What's another name for norepinephrine? Noradrenaline. Okay, that's for people that speak English instead of American. The English call it noradrenaline, we call it norepinephrine. Which one's more widely used? Norepinephrine. Most of the English these days even call it norepinephrine, unless you're a medical student in England. Okay. These are contained in neurons. There's an additional synthetic step that can occur, not in neurons, but in cells in the adrenal cortex. And they have to have one additional enzyme called PNMT. PNMT, phenylethanolamine N-methyltransferase. Say that fast several times in a row. PNMT is a lot easier to spell. PNMT uses norepinephrine as a substrate and converts it into epinephrine. Epinephrine. What's another name for epinephrine? Adrenaline. I'm sure we have more than a few adrenaline junkies in the class right now. Any bungee jumpers or skydivers? Not that you're going to admit it right now. Okay. So we have the rate-limiting enzyme, the enzyme that gets misnamed multiple times, that are required to produce dopamine. And then if it's not a dopamine neuron, it's a norepinephrine neuron, an additional enzyme, DBH. And then if it's not a neuron at all, but it's still producing catecholamines, then an additional enzyme to produce adrenaline or epinephrine. So pretty long biosynthetic pathway, more complicated than some we've looked at. Now again, what was tyrosine hydroxylase called? The rate-limiting enzyme. Okay, this is looking at it in sort of a very functional schema that protein chemists like, where we divide out the catalytic subunit. What does the catalytic subunit of an enzyme do? It's the active portion, what actually drives the reaction. And then the regulatory subunit, this part that's in white. The regulatory subunit for tyrosine hydroxylase is highly unusual because it has not one, not two, not even three, but four different phosphorylation sites by which it can be regulated. Phosphorylation of any of these increases the activity of the enzyme. Phosphorylation of all four of them massively increases the activity. And again, I referred earlier today to the fact that you need to be understanding second messenger systems. Is this a second messenger?
Yes.
Okay, that's dependent upon calcium. Can it autophosphorylate itself? Okay, and the autophosphorylated version of it is capable of phosphorylating two of these four regulatory sites on tyrosine kinase. How about this? Is this another second messenger? PKA? Is that the calcium-dependent protein kinase? What's it dependent on? Cyclic AMP. Okay, the cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinase. Again, that can phosphorylate one of these sites in common with CAMK2. How about this one? Is this a second messenger? PKC. What's it dependent upon? Besides calcium. No, not calmodulin. DAG. Diacylglycerol. It's a third cofactor. Starts with an A, if that helps. ATP. Okay. Again, when it's activated, it can phosphorylate tyrosine kinase. Tyrosine hydroxylase. Then there are other kinase pathways we haven't even gotten into. This isn't intended to be a full biochemistry class. But there are other pathways that converge on tyrosine hydroxylase as well to phosphorylate some of these other sites. So multiple ways that nature has provided to regulate catecholamine biosynthesis. That's generally a clue that this has some critical biological function, a great deal of salience in the function of your nervous system and other nervous systems. Anybody think dopamine's an important neurotransmitter? Probably so. Okay. Unfortunately, it's possible to hijack the biosynthetic pathway that we've looked at. For catecholamines, it's possible to produce what are called false neurotransmitters, or even false substrates, or false precursors that look a lot like catecholamines, but don't activate catecholamine receptors. So the normal pathway, if you have DOPA, it's acted upon by triple ADC and converted into dopamine. Very slight variant of DOPA is a compound called alpha-methyl-DOPA. Remember, this is the alpha carbon. If you add a methyl group there, alpha-methyl-DOPA will act as a perfectly good substrate for triple ADC and produce a false neurotransmitter, alpha-methyl-dopamine. The intracellular machinery inside the neuron will not distinguish between the two. It will package this up just like dopamine into a vesicle, release it in a calcium-dependent fashion, gets to the receptors, they don't recognize it. So you've wasted a lot of enzyme activity that could have gone to producing dopamine. These can actually be clinically useful drugs. Why might you want somebody not to produce a lot of dopamine? Schizophrenia. And we'll talk about related issues in just a few minutes. This false transmitter, alpha-methyl-dopamine, can again be acted upon by DBH to produce not norepinephrine, but the false neurotransmitter alpha-methyl-norepinephrine. Alpha-methyl-norepinephrine. That might have some utility if somebody's got high blood pressure or something of the sort. Too reactive to stressful stimuli. Unfortunately, it would probably result in depression in those patients too. So not as clinically useful. So everybody clear on false substrates and false transmitters. Okay. Very slight chemical modification on this alpha side chain. Right, if we have synthesis, we also have to talk about degradation or breakdown, metabolism of dopamine. There's two important sets of enzymes here. Let's look at the simpler pathway first. We start off with a catecholamine like dopamine. It's acted upon by an enzyme called catechol-O-methyltransferase. Catechol, well, this is a catechol, O-methyltransferase. Yields an intermediate product that I don't particularly care if you learn its name, 3-methoxytyramine. And that serves then as a substrate for the next enzyme, monoamine oxidase. MAO, monoamine oxidase. This has one single amine ring, monoamine oxidase, creating the metabolite of dopamine that's typically seen in the spinal fluid and also excreted from the body, homovanillate, or homovanillic acid, if you prefer the American nomenclature. HVA is perfectly acceptable. Homovanillate. Alternatively, we can go a different pathway. Instead of starting with C-O-M-P, start with M-A-O. You're going to have M-A-O and C-O-M-P in the pathway one way or the other. This pathway is a little more complicated because you produce an additional intermediary that is an aldehyde. It has to be acted upon by an aldehyde dehydrogenase. This pathway tends to produce hangovers. You would prefer to go that way. The aldehyde dehydrogenase generates an additional secondary byproduct, DOPAC, dihydroxyphenyl acetate. DOPAC's a lot easier to spell and say. The DOPAC then is acted upon by the enzyme that was first in the other pathway, COMT. And DOPAC then again gets converted into the same final byproduct, HVA, homovanillate. So you either start with COMT and finish with MAO, or you start with MAO and finish with COMT. Clear? Okay. So what do we do with dopamine? What are dopaminergic ligands or dopaminergic drugs good for? Clinically, a wide range of different uses. They've been used as appetite suppressants or diet drugs, antidepressants, probably the biggest category of prescriptions these days. Antipsychotics, particularly for treatment of schizophrenia, but not just limited to schizophrenia. As fatigue suppressants, keep you awake long periods of time, to enhance attention, for treatment of motor disorders like Parkinsonism, but not limited to Parkinsonism. And as agents that affect blood pressure, pressor agents. Now, of course, not all the uses of the drugs are approved by the FDA. So some of these same purposes, people will self-medicate. But down towards the bottom of the list are additional effects that often prompt people to self-medicate. They can mimic the state of mania, feeling like you're on top of the world, and perhaps literally ruling the world, and knowing more, and capable of doing more than certainly any other mere mortal around you. In fact, some of these can serve as mild hallucinogens, distort reality, or at least distort our so-called normal perception of reality. So let's talk for a moment about the basis for prescription of an awful lot of these drugs. What's often called the biogenic amine hypothesis of both affect and psychosis. What does affect mean? Mood. Clinically, it's often divided between sort of polar extremes, mania on one hand, very elevated mood, and depression at the other end of the continuum, at the other end of the spectrum, very depressed mood. In fact, can go to the point of suicide at that end of the spectrum. It was long ago noted the effect that's shown on this graph, that as people age, levels of catecholamines and of other biogenic amines decline, particularly of dopamine, but also of norepinephrine and of a related biogenic amine, serotonin. It was also noted that as the severity of depression increased, levels of catecholamines tended to be lower, and of other biogenic amines like serotonin. So the catecholamine or biogenic amine hypothesis was born that if you had low levels and you had low affect, well, you just boost levels and everything would be fine. Within some limits, because then you could get to the other end of the spectrum, mania, which is also tended to be frowned upon socially. Okay. Turns out that dopamine has many different functions in the nervous system, but it's perhaps most widely known as the hedonic or pleasure neurotransmitter. It makes you feel good. It transmits the concept of reward within your nervous system, or perhaps an older term, motivation. Turns out that people and experimental animals alike will work very hard to increase dopamine levels in the nervous system, or to do things that will manipulate dopamine receptors in the nervous system to increase activation of them. It's part of the reason why there's problems with people not taking prescribed medications when they suffer from schizophrenia or from the manic phase of bipolar disorders. Because it feels really good to have high levels of dopamine. Why would you want to take a drug that prevents that when people will pay literally thousands of dollars of money for drugs that will do the opposite, that will elevate levels of dopamine? So it's a clinical problem those of you that want to go to medical school are going to have to contend with on a regular basis. Certainly plays an important role in drug addiction. And the majority of the people in the psychiatry department down at Southwestern, that's their major area of research. Plays an important role in learning and memory. Certainly plays a role in various psychoses, including schizophrenia. Plays important roles, though, in normal homeostatic function of the nervous system as well. Now, you'll see in a lot of textbooks some very over-simplistic-looking Venn diagrams trying to attribute specific functions to different neurotransmitters. Almost none of that is based on actual neuroscience research, so I'm not even going to bother discussing it at this point in time. Occasionally, you may see diagrams like this, trying to explain a particular emotional state, like the feelings of love. Turns out even there, a single neurotransmitter is not enough to account for what goes on. In the early stages of feelings of love for another individual, if we measure different chemical substances in the body, the ones that go up initially are the gonadal steroid hormones, testosterone and estrogen. Perhaps not characterized so much as love as lust. It's in later stages where you get increases in the biogenic amines, particularly in dopamine, but also in the others. Norepinephrine, serotonin, even in histamine. And it's the final stages, a more stable long-term relationship, that you then begin to get increases in some of the hypothalamic substances like vasopressin, oxytocin. That means it's not just a one-night event, but a longer-term relationship. So any proponent that claims that a single neurotransmitter can describe any psychological phenomenon in the nervous system, just walk away. You're better off than trying to argue with them. All right, let's shift gears again. We took care of biosynthesis and of some uses. How do we get these things packaged into vesicles? We have to have transporters. The vesicular transporter for dopamine is called a VDAT, V for vesicular, DA for dopamine, and T for transporter, VDATs. They are proton dependent. So you require an ATPase to pump protons in. At least this only requires one proton. And the ATP can interact on the outside of the vesicle, so you don't have to pump ATP in either. So it's simpler than the cholinergic transporter. Very typical structure, 12 transmembrane segments. We've seen transporters an awful lot. For this, there are actually some clinically prescribed drugs. The one that you will still see prescriptions written for is a drug called reserpine. Older psychiatrists will still use this for treatment of the manic phase of bipolar, for schizophrenia, and occasionally even for blood pressure regulation. Not nearly as many prescriptions written for this drug anymore because it has side effects. Depending on which of those you're trying to treat, it affects the others as well. Does this look like a very simple molecule? Really complicated. Guess what? This molecule also has similar effects. Structure and function, again, do not always follow in the nervous system. Which of these do you think would get across the blood-brain barrier easier? That one? You'd be wrong. It's more polar, so this one actually gets across the blood-brain barrier easier. Size doesn't always affect that either. Hence, it's the one that's more often clinically used. Reserpine. Then a topic that we're going to spend some time on, synaptic transporters for dopamine, DATs. These are found in the cell membrane. Again, they have 12 transmembrane segments. One of the functional properties that's important, they are a sodium and chloride ion dependent transporter. Sodium and chloride dependent. That would be relevant if we didn't have much sodium and chloride in our diets and in our extracellular fluid. Is that true? We don't have much? We have lots of it. But without it, it would not function. Turns out that the drug Wabane that we've talked about before, remember this one that sounds like it should be spelled with a W? It is not. It interferes with sodium potassium ATPases. Can disturb the balance of sodium ions. So it can indirectly interfere with these transporters. Wabane. Believe it or not, we've already mentioned multiple drugs today. Correct? We're not done. Before you panic at the next chart, take a deep breath and let it out slowly. We're going to concentrate just on the left-hand side of this chart for today. Okay? We're going to be talking about reuptake inhibitors, which is the clinical term that's used, or more properly, transporter inhibitors. They block these cell membrane transporters. We're going to concentrate for today on those that have effects on dopamine transporters. Okay? Now, this chart is broken down into several sections by the specificity of the drug. We'll start first with non-specific drugs. Indatrolene is a widely prescribed antidepressant drug. It affects dopamine transporters, but also transporters for the other biogenic amines. That works well for some people that have apparently imbalances in multiple transmitter systems. Indatrolene. Or for the self-medicators out there, this drug that we've seen before, cocaine. What do we see cocaine having a role in?
Sodium chloride.
sodium channel blocker is a local anesthetic. People don't typically go out and go, gee, I'd like to get really numb. I'm going to pay a few thousand dollars to do that.
Figuratively.
Well, their nose might get a bit numb. But more typically, they're doing it for the dopamine high, to boost dopamine levels in their nervous system by preventing its reuptake. Of course, it doesn't prevent just dopamine reuptake, but also norepinephrine and serotonin as well. And maybe they were a little depressed, so self-medication is doing pretty much the same thing as the endatriline prescription they could have gotten. Unfortunately, most people don't figure out the dose they're taking when they ingest cocaine. Psychiatrists these days don't prescribe cocaine. Not since Sigmund Freud's days has that been the case. Freud was a big promoter of cocaine for lifting of depression. Primarily gave it to women because he thought women were biologically depressed. Maybe just the women that Freud knew. Then we have the next category of reuptake blockers. It includes a drug we've talked about before again, bupropion, marketed as Wellbutrin. You may remember any other use for bupropion. Okay, for blocking some of the nicotinic receptors. Okay. Turns out the bupropion also blocks both the dopamine transporter and the related catecholamine transporter for norepinephrine. Doesn't really have much effect on serotonin or other biogenic amines. Bupropion. And it's an effective antidepressant for a certain percentage of patients, not for others. Okay. We're going to ignore the drugs that don't affect dopamine transporters right now. Those will be appropriated in later lectures. Then we're going to look at the drugs that are more specific for dopamine transporters. The majority of their effect is on dopamine transporters. A couple drugs that are widely prescribed as antidepressants: nalmefenthrin and duloxetine. Nalmefenthrin and duloxetine, prescribed as antidepressants. Then we have another category of drugs, amphetamine drugs. Yes?
I thought duloxetine was an SNRI.
Duloxetine?
Yeah.
Not so much. Now, the best evidence shows it's primarily on the dopamine reuptake. Anybody ever heard of this drug?
Oh, yeah.
Adderall. Okay. You can actually get a prescription for Adderall. Hopefully you're not trading Adderall with your roommates. Highly illegal. Adderall is a mixture of several amphetamines. And we'll look at amphetamines in just a moment. Major effect of amphetamines are on dopamine reuptake. It does have cross-reactivity with some of the others as well, but the predominant effect is on the dopamine reuptake. What's the amphetamine that's probably most famous these days? Meth, methamphetamine. The one over on the right-hand side here. Methamphetamine. We're not going to tell you how to biosynthesize it.
It is. That's what the internet's for.
Don't believe everything on the internet either, though. There's some very bad recipes out there with very toxic byproducts. We'll talk about some of the consequences of that in a moment. Methamphetamine, of course, is sensationalized for the effects that it has on chronic users. Those two pictures are taken about 4 months apart. First arrest and about 15th arrest. Looks like a longer period of time had gone by than just a few months. But the prototypic drug within this category is amphetamine itself. Then there's some very slight elaborations added. Again, at this end of this structure that you should be recognizing, this basic catechol structure. Dexamphetamine, or dextroamphetamine, or dexedrine, slightly more potent than the basic amphetamine. Methamphetamine, with this extra methyl group, the side chain of its own, the most potent of those. And how about this drug we mentioned before? Adderall. It's a mixture of both of these. Amphetamine and dexamphetamine. In fact, multiple different versions of each. The old street name for amphetamines was Speed. Anyone know where that name came from?
From its effects.
From what?
From its effects.
From permissive sex.
No, from its effects.
From its effects. Okay.
Whoa.
Well, maybe both. I thought that was a weird answer, but
that's on record too.
Yeah, it's on.
That,
it's recorded.
Oh yeah.
The amphetamines were originally synthesized in Japan.
Really?
Yeah. And the amphetamines have been widely used, particularly in World War II, but even to this day, by the militaries of different countries. Japanese Army used it in World War II. The German Army did. The American and British armies did as well.
I thought we used it on our fighter pilots.
We used it throughout the armed forces.
Only like even now.
We occasionally still give dexamphetamines to long-range bomber pilots more commonly because they're flying very long missions. Probably not a good one for fighter pilots.
I just remember there was something about the Air Force.
Mm-hmm. My father was a bomber pilot. He used to have a regular prescription for it. But then again, we give school kids Adderall. Which is a combination not just of the dextroamphetamine, but also of amphetamine itself. Why would we give Adderall out? What's it used for?
ADHD.
Well, depending on which nomenclature you like, ADHD or ADD, attention deficit disorder. It used to be called hyperactivity.
Yeah. I thought ADD was more of the quiet, like spacing out, and ADHD was the head of hyperactivity.
That depends on who's doing the definition for it. Okay. It, even though the DSM-5 is out now, the definitions still aren't clear. Okay. But this would be a very sort of stereotypic, prototypic profile for an ADD or ADHD kid without their drug. Very hard to deal with them in a classroom setting. They tend not to like to stay in their seats, not be quiet, not pay attention to what's going on in class. Not a good sheep-like behavior. Okay. Turns out that if you give them an amphetamine-like drug, they're actually calmer. Actually better able to pay attention to what's going on in class. Sounds antithetical, right?
No.
No? Why would that be possible?
No,
actually, it turns out that it's probably a relatively selective effect on the frontal lobes. The major function of the frontal lobes is to inhibit activity, prevent you from doing things.
Oh,
to use a Freudian term, to act sort of as the super ego. That voice in the back of your head, although it's actually in the front of your head. Tell you don't do it. Not a good idea. That then allows you to attend to other things that you wouldn't be doing if you weren't inhibited. Okay.
Do you know exactly where that and the frontal lobe is acting on there?
Well, you can measure firing activity of pyramidal neurons in the frontal lobe, and they're increased.
Oh, okay, I see.
And they're connected to major inhibitory circuits. So long, long pathways that are inhibitory. There are other drugs, of course, besides Adderall that are used. Another one that's widely prescribed is the drug that most people know as Ritalin, which you should know by its generic name, methylphenidate. Methylphenidate. Again, strong amphetamine-like properties, even though the chemical structure is quite a bit different. It's not a catechol any longer. Another one that's occasionally used is phenmetrazine. Phenmetrazine. A couple others you're not going to get prescriptions for. Cocaine. Although it is still used as a dental anesthetic. And this one you'll never get a prescription for. MDMA. Widely known as ecstasy. And various chemical relatives of MDMA. What the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency these days, calls designer drugs. Because originally the way the law was written, it banned a very specific chemical compound. So somebody said, gee, you know, if we add another nitrile group here, doesn't really change the effect of the drug, but it's not the same chemical any longer. So now the whole generic category is banned.
Yep. Isn't ecstasy neurotoxic as well?
There is a literature that says so. The literature needs more careful evaluation, though. That came out of groups that were essentially being paid to produce that effect. So the data has not been replicated in other independent laboratories. So it's not confirmed. Although if you look at official government pronouncements, they say that.
What about people using it for therapy and PTSD?
There has been a wide use of it outside the U.S., still prevented in the U.S. legally. Actually seems to have some of the same benefits of other hallucinogens as an adjunct to other forms of therapy. Not going to see it happening in the state of Texas anytime soon, though.
Well, I think there are people doing it in the U.S., but it's like an underground.
Yeah, and they can be arrested immediately for it.
Of course.
Well, no, yeah, of course. It is a fact that it is illegal.
No, I agree.
Okay.
No problem there.
Okay. And, of course, there are multiple variants of all of these. Some of them available by prescription, others by less legal means. If you depend on the internet for your source of drugs or for your knowledge of how to make drugs, you can end up with some very bad consequences. There are multiple different pathways by which you can produce different neurotoxins. One that's well characterized is one that's called MPTP. MPTP. By itself, it's relatively inert, until it's taken up into glial cells and converted by the MAO enzyme found in glial cells into a very neurotoxic substance. Be fine if it stayed inside the glial cells, but they re-release it. Remember, glial cells release all sorts of things, almost like neurons do, but they don't package them up in vesicles typically to do it. And when MPP is taken up into dopamine neurons, it's transported into the mitochondria and shuts down the Krebs cycle. So very rapidly and selectively kills dopamine neurons. And you can essentially rapidly cause the onset of Parkinsonism. And there have been any number of notable individuals who developed Parkinsonism early and rapidly. it's hard to make the evidential link that that might have been related to their drug use. But it is very likely or possible. That's his picture right there. Yeah. No definitive proof there, but it seems highly possible. Okay. There are other neurotoxins as well. Those of you that have had past versions of our lab methods course might be familiar with 6-hydroxydopamine. Again, a selective dopaminergic neurotoxin. Kills dopamine-producing neurons. Doesn't diffuse very far, so you can inject it locally into the substantia nigra, the pars compacta, and just wipe out that population of dopamine neurons. Not something you'd probably choose to do for yourself, but does make it a useful experimental model. All right, so what have we left out of the story about dopamine? We've done synthesis, packaging, reuptake, toxins. Anything else important about neurotransmitters? Receptors. Okay. These are metabotropic receptors. So how many transmembrane segments? 70 MRs. We've talked about dimerization before for metabotropic receptors, right? Well, it turns out for dopamine, this is probably the most complicated of the stories we know of. They are found natively and functionally as monomers. One single 7 transmembrane segment protein. They're also found as dimers. 2 of them combined. Sometimes the 2 of the same, but very often they're found as heterodimers. And in fact, they have been found dimerized not just with other dopamine receptors, but with receptors for other transmitters. One most commonly that they're found with is for somatostatin. Somatostatin. From its name alone, somatostatin, where do you think that might be found? It's a peripheral transmitter, largely. Mainly found in the gastrointestinal area. The so-called enteric nervous system. It regulates blood vessels down there in the gut. And you'll find it co-expressed and dimerized with dopamine receptors. We still don't exactly understand what's going on there. Anybody know how many types of dopamine receptors there are? 2? 5. Somebody did their readings for today. There are 5 types of dopamine receptors. They are labeled 1 through 5. D1, D2, D3, D4, D5. Have we seen a number scheme like that before? Why, yes, for muscarinic receptors. To help you keep track of it, fortuitously, they're a bit different. It's not odds versus evens here. And to simplify things, we often discuss it as D1-like receptors, which literally means D1 and D5, so both ends of the table. And again, those are the excitatory ones. In this case, they're tied not to a GQ, though, but to a GS. What does a GS alpha subunit do? Stimulate what? AC, adenylate cyclase. And then we also talk about the others as being D2-like receptors, which means everything but D1 and D5, D2, 3, and 4. And those are all tied to GIs. And what does a GI do? Inhibit what? Adenylate cyclase, the same enzyme. So you can think of them as flip sides of the same effect. The D1-like ones stimulated adenylate cyclase activity. The D2-like ones inhibit adenylate cyclase activity. So which of the protein kinases that we've talked about would be affected by dopamine? Only one of the three major ones. PKC, CAM kinase, PKA. What is PKA? Well, what does the A stand for? Cyclic AMP dependent protein kinase. What's the product of adenylate cyclase? Cyclic AMP. What's the substrate for adenylate cyclase? ATP. How many of you paid attention at the beginning of the class today when I said you need to be able to use your information about second messenger systems? I wasn't joking. I do joke occasionally, but that wasn't a joke. Okay. Do we typically only ever see effects of just alpha subunits? No, there can also be beta-gamma subunit effects. And in fact, they're very common for dopamine type 2 receptors, D2s, which do things to voltage-dependent calcium channels. They downregulate them. Turns out that is the mechanism for the autoreceptor effect of D2 receptors. D2 receptors follow the naming rule. If it has a 2 in it, it could be an autoreceptor. They also downregulate voltage-dependent and calcium-dependent potassium channels. Which is somewhat contrary to an inhibitory effect, because that can actually make cells more excitable. So dopamine is a quirky drug. It can both up and down regulate cellular function, because any given cell might express one type of receptor, but more commonly will express multiple types. In fact, that's what this color map shows. You see the areas in green?
Yes.
Cortical cells, particularly pyramidal neurons, express every type of dopamine receptor, D1 through D5. The basal ganglia, that gets its input from the substantia nigra, mostly D1 and D2. Opposite effects. Some areas, like the hypothalamus, mostly D3 and D5. Again, opposite effects. So dopamine can be both an upregulator and a downregulator of phosphorylation in neurons, often at the same time. So not a simple picture from dopamine. Very complex set of effects. Right. If you think that's complex, again, please take a deep breath and let's break down the next chart. Agonists for dopamine receptors. Agonists. Now, how many types of receptors were there?
Five.
Which ones were the stimulatory or excitatory ones? D1 and D5, the D1-like receptors. Well, not surprising, since they're dopamine receptors, dopamine agonizes all of them. It's the endogenous agonist. How many check marks are over here? It's more potent at D5 receptors than the others. Those are much rarer receptors. But they're found throughout the forebrain and the hypothalamus. There are some clinically useful drugs that mimic dopamine that agonize all five types. In fact, we use one of them in our lab class. apomorphine. Don't be confused because it looks like it says morphine. Apomorphine has nothing to do with opiate receptors. It agonizes all five types of dopamine receptors. It's often prescribed for Parkinson's patients. Another one that's widely prescribed for Parkinson's and also for migraine is glyceride. Glyceride. All five types of dopamine receptors. Then we get into drugs that are prescribed more for Parkinsonism with some degree of specificity to block some of the inhibitory effects that show up in Parkinsonism. Drugs like quinpirole and bromocriptine. Quinpirole and bromocriptine. Quinpirole blocks D2s and D3, I'm sorry, agonizes D2s and D3s, while bromocriptine agonizes all of the D2-like receptors, 2s, 3s, and 4s. So primarily pushing the inhibitory effects, at least through the alpha subunits, but also perhaps pushing the autoreceptor effects. Then we have a newer category of drugs prescribed for this disorder. That's not inability to sleep. It's called restless leg syndrome. Tends not to be just the legs involved. People who are woken in the night because of very large movements going on in their body. In fact, it looks like it's an inability to generate the paralysis or the lack of muscle tone, particularly in REM sleep. But these people, it's also showing up very strongly in slow wave sleep as well. So a couple of newer drugs that are prescribed, again, primarily acting on D2 and D3 receptors. Primarily, it's believed through the autoreceptor effect. Pramipexole, and ropinirole. Ropinirole. They both have this O-L-E, which in Texas we should properly pronounce Ole, right? Suffix. Marketed again for treatment of restless leg syndrome. Okay, so divide the drugs up by what they do, what they're used for. That might help you remember them, as well as what receptor they act on. In fact, the more ways you can think of to categorize drugs, probably the easier it will be to remember them. Now, in a kind world, this would be the end of drugs, right? We've only done agonists, though, right? We also have to deal with antagonists. Okay? No ion channels to affect, so we're not going to talk about non-competitives. These are competitive antagonists. And it turns out the majority of the drugs that we'll talk about are actually marketed as antipsychotic drugs. At least that was what they were originally marketed for. These days you can get a prescription and have never shown any sign of schizophrenia because they are found to be useful for some other purposes as well. Now, probably the drug that would be most useful is this one at the top, spipirone. Spipirone. Notice how potent it is at all these different receptors. Very potent. Stays bound for long times to dopamine receptors. We've seen spipirone before, and we're going to continue to see it. In lieu of that earlier comment where I misheard something, if we were talking about sexual activity of spipirone, we would say it was very promiscuous. Not very choosy. It binds to all sorts of receptors. Spipirone. So probably not a drug of choice where you want to have some specificity of action. Let's go down the chart here to this middle portion. Many of these drugs have been around for a long time. An older term for these drugs was the term neuroleptics. Neuroleptics. Primarily because if you give someone a high enough dose of them, it knocks them out. Causes lepsia. Renders them unconscious. Neuroleptic drugs. Probably the first choice for most psychiatrists when somebody is presenting with an extreme case of psychosis. You render them unconscious. Then you reduce the dose, see if you can talk to them while they're still under the drug, see if you can then fine-tune things. Makes people much easier to deal with when they're not trying to kill themselves or kill you or destroy everything in their immediate vicinity or stand out on the interstate in direct traffic. All of which can help, can happen without the drug treatment. So neuroleptic drugs, the one that's still probably most commonly used at intake is haloperidol. Haloperidol. Very potent on D2 receptors, but also the other D2-like receptors. Haloperidol. Hard to get a low enough dose that people aren't really groggy. So other drugs were developed. Thorazine is still more commonly used inpatient. You should know the generic name, chlorpromazine. Chlorpromazine. For outpatient therapy, more commonly, trifluoperazine is used, marketed as stelazine. Those drugs have been around since the 30s and 40s. These days, a slightly more potent D2 selective drug, amisulpride, is often used. Amisulpride still affects all the D2-like receptors, but more potent on D2s. Or a drug like pemazide. Pemazide. And this list could go on for pages. Those are the ones that you're most likely to see. Now, we do have some drugs that are specific for D1s, like ecopipam. Ecopipam can sometimes be useful for treatment of some of the side effects of other Parkinson's medications. Ecopipam. Or a few people are helped by the selective D4 antagonist, clozapine. But primarily drug companies, when they're looking for drugs for this category of treatment, as neuroleptic drugs, or the more common phrase these days is antipsychotic drugs, they're particularly looking for the potency on D2 receptors. Okay. Now, is that the only way that people are treated with drugs for psychiatric disorders? No, we're going to be talking about other reuptake inhibitors, those for norepinephrine or cross-reactivity with norepinephrine and dopamine, or those specific for serotonin or with cross-reactivity for all of the others. But there's also the drug lithium. Lithium. Lithium, of course, is an ion. We know this diagram is wrong. Problem is, we don't know what the right diagram is. We know that dopamine-acting drugs, particularly the D2 drugs, can have effects on the autoreceptors, presynaptic receptors, that act through the beta-gamma subunits, downregulate calcium influx, and thus decrease the amount of dopamine that's being released. But they also, of course, have postsynaptic effects on D2 receptors as well. Okay. Now, D2 receptors and the D1-like receptor all converge their alpha subunit effects on adenylate cyclase. And through its product, cyclic AMP, on PKA pathways. But there are other kinase pathways that seem to be important in various disorders in the nervous system. And the one that's been widely implicated is phospholipase C and turnover of phosphoinositides. Remember the one that's in the membrane? What's the one in the membrane? PIP2. Lithium initially was thought to interfere strongly with generation of PIP2. It does do that initially. But people that are on lithium long term, their levels of PIP2 are normal. So if that's the primary effect of lithium, it ought to quit working. It doesn't. Continues to be effective when other drugs are not. So we know this diagram is at least incomplete. It may be wrong. Trouble is, we don't know what the right diagram is.
What do you think about the people who are doing research saying that lithium regenerates gray matter?
Regenerates gray matter. Causes growth of new neurons?
It would appear so.
Because that's what gray matter is.
Yeah.
Well, it could just be it changes the relative abundance of myelination as well. So not really growing new neurons per se. They haven't done really good quantitative methods to look at the number of neurons, more looking at volume.
Yeah.
And that's not the same thing. Not the same thing at all. Okay. All right. That's enough for dopamine. We will talk about norepinephrine on Thursday.